This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we've got three sponsors for the show. You know them. They are Jam Software, makers of enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies, such as Macs, iPads, iPhone, and Apple TV in education. More about them at jamsoftware.com. Secondly, Shobi, an iPad app for paperless classrooms. Shobi makes it easy to assign, collect, and review student work and to provide rich feedback with annotations, voice notes, and more. And finally, this episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com/outofschool and enter the offer code PUPIL at checkout. A better web starts with your website. Bradley, how are you doing?
I am fantastic. We are coming up on the end of school, and mm-hmm. You know, this is, I guess, my fifth year ending. Mm-hmm. I guess I need to figure that out. Either I'm coming to the end of my fifth or my sixth year. I'm almost worked here 6 years, so I guess it would be my fifth end of school. And you always think that the end of school is like starts to slow down. Mm-hmm. And then you get here and you realize that it is as busy as any time of year. And mm-hmm. it's a lot of little things.
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of closing up to do, isn't there?
Yeah, so we're recording on the 7th. Our last day is basically 2 weeks and a day away. So, just anxiously trying to land that plane.
You guys get a fantastic summer holiday. I mean, we get a pretty good one too, don't get me wrong, but we're not done until the end of June.
Yeah, so we're done. We're generally always done the Friday before Memorial Day. Mm-hmm. And Memorial Day is a little early this year, being on the 25th here in the U.S., and so often Memorial Day will be on the 30th or the 31st, and so we'll go a little later. And mm-hmm. then we actually go back, I think, maybe the 19th this year of August. So we get a pretty good summer break this year.
Okay, yeah, that's comparable to when we go back, but you're off a good few weeks before us.
Yeah, so yeah, just trying to wrap that up. Got a lot of maintenance to do this summer on our database and a lot of our technology. And then over the summer, we'll start planning our next refresh and trying to figure out what that looks like, because that is less than a year away. And we've had many months of planning and negotiating with leasing companies and things like that. And it always just sneaks up on you.
Yeah, but we're pretty much in the same boat. Our refresh is a year in the summer as well. So I think this is kind of the starting gun on a year's worth of podcast commentary about how this whole process is going. So it'll be interesting to follow along, hopefully. We'll share our insights, such as they may be.
Yeah. Before we move on, let's thank our first sponsor of the night. It's the fine folks at Squarespace. You guys know Squarespace. They are the all-in-one platform. Makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com/out of school and the offer code PUPIL at checkout. A better web starts with your website. Again, if you need a website or you have a website that's on WordPress, maybe you're getting tired of all the updates and the security exploits and the plugin updates, definitely check out Squarespace. They're on version 7. It's highly scalable, so it's great for just a one-page website or all the way up to a big e-commerce site. Like, all plans have e-commerce included, and all the payment processing is handled through Stripe. Could not be easier to set up. 24/7 support via email and chat is extremely fantastic. If you pay by the year, you get a free domain name as well. Otherwise, it's just $8 a month. They have a great app for blogging from iOS that supports Markdown as well. So if you like to write Markdown, it's a great place to start. So if you're looking for a place to start a website, check out squarespace.com/out of school and use the offer code PUPIL at checkout. Thanks to Squarespace for sponsoring the show this week.
I, in fact, did exactly that thing this week. I used Markdown in my Squarespace blog to write a piece, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. I wanted to tell you another story, though, before Bradley. This week is our big school trip to Paris, which we do sort of once every 5 years. And there's 10 staff and parent helpers away on that trip. And a good proportion of the kids, basically all my classes are gone this week, which has been rather nice. Some of them are gone because it's exam leave, and some of them are gone because they're in Paris. But it has been a very quiet week for me. And that left me some time to do some thinking. But one of the things that happened when the team were away in Paris was that a big feature of the trip is we've been using one of our blogs to kind of communicate with parents about the trip and so on. And a big idea was that we were going to use the blog to post pictures from Paris. And it was great. It was going great for the first day. And then, as far as we can tell, the school might have actually wiped out the hotel's bandwidth allocation for the week. So that has not gone too well. But it's been quite interesting, though, because one of the things that it highlighted was that a lot of iOS apps are really bad in unreliable network situations. And there's some that are good and some that recover well, but most of them seem to just fall over in these high latency, you know, long ping times. Everything that's bad about hotel Wi-Fi seems to be like death to many iOS apps that include some networking technology. So the CMS that we use for our school website is called Weebly, and their iOS app has historically been frankly terrible. And it was one of those ones that just failed and failed and failed. So in the end, about the only thing that the team could really to get work was occasionally good old email, and more often than not, WhatsApp. Now, WhatsApp seemed to be the one service that did an excellent job, which I think is really interesting, because you would, given that WhatsApp is very popular in a lot of kind of emerging markets, it would seem that they have actually done an excellent job of supporting the kinds of networks that you might find in countries that maybe don't have very well-developed wireless infrastructure, such as France. Their app was really great. So what happened was that I installed WhatsApp for the first time. I'm not really a WhatsApp user. And the team were sending me back photos over WhatsApp, which I was then sort of saving onto my computer and posting from here, which has kept everybody happy and kept all the parents informed with what's going on and so on. So that was quite a useful way to do it. Although when somebody WhatsApps you 30 photos in a row, it turns out to be quite a pain in the butt to get them all off your phone and onto your Mac, because AirDrop wasn't working, a typical Apple networking stack rubbish. But what I ended up doing was I ended up using the Transmit extension on my phone to SFTP the files up to a Linux machine on EC2 and then download them through Terminal on my Mac. So that was my super modern workflow, involved sending off to a Linux computer somewhere in the depths of a data center in Ireland, and then getting those pictures back onto my Mac and then posting them through the web browser. So that was my tale of bandwidth woe for this week from Paris.
I found that certain apps do that mass download really well and upload really well. Mm-hmm. Facebook, for example, here's a common workflow we have for that. So we post a lot of our just kind of random field trip pictures. We'll just post it on our Facebook page, mm-hmm. Mainly because that's where parents, kind of like the push marketing, like that's where our parents are at, mm-hmm. and that's where a lot of our prospective parents are. And so we're trying to really be there instead of just having it on our website. We want to go to where people are. And so it's very common for teachers to iMessage me 15 pictures in a row. Mm-hmm. There is a way on iOS, if you go into the details, that you can save mm-hmm. all the pictures, like you can tap them and then save them all at once. Yeah. And then the Facebook, I don't know about the actual Facebook app, because I don't use that, because I don't have a personal Facebook. I just use the Facebook Pages app. Mm-hmm. Then you could actually upload multiple pictures at a time, and it works very well. But yeah, I've been in those situations where you just don't have a good way to get like 15 pictures from your phone to somewhere else.
Yeah. See, WhatsApp doesn't actually allow you to mass save them to your camera roll. You can sort of do it one at a time. But there's a like in iMessage, there's a details pane. But then when you try and you can select them all, but then you share them and it doesn't have that many options. So I ended up doing the transmit thing. I also tried iMessaging the entire thread back to myself, which was a horrible situation to be in, because then iMessage on the Mac, I had to kind of drag them out of iMessage one by one. So workflows are hard, is what we're saying, I think.
I've seen the transmit app be helpful in situations like that. I've mm-hmm. got a Mac Mini at Mac Mini Colo. And one of the user accounts is just my account logged in with like Dropbox and Google Drive installed. And in a pinch, it's like handy to be able to do that, like, because you know you can take it from somewhere and get it into something else that you know it'll be on all your devices. So, yeah, it's a complete nerd workflow, but it's also nice to have.
Yep, the old workflows are the best, aren't they?
Those trips are fun. Our fifth grade class trip is kind of the same way. And I used to think it was kind of funny that we just constantly wanted to share this stuff, mm-hmm. but parents want to know, like they want to know like what their kids are doing, how's it going. And yeah, it's important when they're on those trips just to keep parents informed on how it's going.
There were rumblings of discontent when there was a sort of 8-hour break in the posting of photographs, you know, people have really engaged with it. And, I mean, that's great. I think it's great that parents are doing that as well, because there's some quite young kids going on that trip, and for many of them, it's their first time away from home. So everybody's quite keen to feel that their kids are getting on okay. One of the things that we don't do is we don't let them just call home whenever they like, because that can end up in a big emotional turmoil of homesickness. But there's a period in the week where they do get to phone home. But these photographs have been quite a good way for parents to see that their kids are happy and relaxed and enjoying themselves and so on. I had toyed actually in the meantime with trying to maybe set up a school Instagram account as a way to do that. But I may do that in the future.
Well, the problem with Instagram is that the app still doesn't have multi-sign-in.
Yeah.
And so you have to sign in and out of your personal account, and nor can you post from the web.
Yeah, and this is it.
Yeah, don't see how they haven't fixed that, especially with their push towards brands.
You would think so, yeah. Or at least there might be like a kind of, like you're saying, Facebook Pages, right, which is an app that your brand can use to kind of manage a Facebook presence without it being your personal login. You can imagine that it would be sensible to use a kind of Facebook or Instagram management app, if you like, for your brand.
Yeah, because there's no API to post, or not a public API, and so there's no way to schedule posts. So we would love to be able to schedule posts and things like that. But so I actually had a trip this week. I went to Washington, D.C. on Sunday, and I got back late Monday night with the folks from Kirby. So that was a lot of fun. We had some meetings looking at the future of that product, and a lot of fun. And, of course, that impacts a lot of schools as well. Mm-hmm. And then I will be at if anybody is in Nashville, I will be at the Cool Springs Nashville store on May the 16th at 8:30 doing a presentation on parent safety for iPads, for like iPads at the house. And so if you're in the area, love to see you there. See you there.
Good parent safety tip is don't try and take it off your children. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. We want to do another sponsor, and then we'll dive into the meat of the show, Bradley. How about that?
Let's thank Jamf Software. They provide IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies such as Macs, iPads, iPhones, and Apple TVs in schools and businesses. They have a great app called Casper Focus for the teacher's iPad that allows them to take control of their deployment. It allows the teachers to quickly gain students' attention, conduct secure exams within an app, select a specific Apple TV assigned to their class, choose and distribute iBooks, and they can even initiate AirPlay right from within Casper Focus. Learn more about Casper Focus and the Casper Suite from jampsoftware.com. Thanks to Jamf for sponsoring the show this week.
Mm-hmm. So, Bradley, I told you that I had nothing to do this week at school, so I couldn't stop myself but sitting and thinking for a while, and I try to do as little of that as possible, but it happened this week. And the result of that was that I ended up thinking about some of these long-term issues that we have to deal with as school systems administrators and so on. And the result of that was that I took a long, hard look at our mobile device management system structure and came up with a number of ideas for how we're going to change it and basically what's wrong with it. And I thought we would try and dig into that tonight.
Absolutely.
Sound good? Well, what's the hardest problem in school sysadmin? What do you think it is?
Well, the things are always changing. So like if you're in a regular business, to me, you have departments, and those generally don't change that often. With schools, every year kids are constantly moving to the next year, and they have these different kind of groups that are shifting around.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That I would completely agree with that. I think that's one of the number one difficulty. And also that the configuration of location and staff assigned to these groups and so on also changes each year. And that can sort of lead you to a situation, the kind of situation that I'm in right now, where some of your kind of administrative structures are quite out of date compared to the way the world actually is right now. And I think that to generalize, the problem is having your representation of the school in digital form, whether that be your Active Directory or your student database or your Wi-Fi passwords or your Google Drive structure or your device management system. Having that actually reflect reality is quite challenging, and trying to design a method by which you can structure your digital system, whichever one it is, in a way that will keep pace with reality was kind of the focus of my thinking. And I ended up blogging about this, and I called it Mobile Device Management Structure Design for the Long Term. And what I tried to do was I tried to figure out, well, what is this currently annoying me about our system, and how should I change it to make it much less annoying in the future? Which is what we all want, right?
Well, and you know, I think one of the things to think about is that while we've been managing Active Directory servers and we've been managing Mac management systems, and we've been managing Wi-Fi. You know, iPad mobile device management is still a relatively new thing, and we've seen so many changes in the deployment technology and strategy that it's easy for your house to basically get out of order.
Yeah, you can definitely not only get out of pace with reality in your school, but you can also have a lot of kind of legacy information and structures designed for previous deployments. And really, that's where I kind of found myself this week, was looking at our Casper installation and saying, man, this is a hairy ball of mess, and I should probably fix it. And let me tell you why it is such a mess, and then I'll kind of try and explain what I'm going to do to fix it. But basically, where I think a lot of the difficulty comes from is that when we first set up this MDM, we were using volume purchase, yes, but we were using the coupon code system, which was the old way in which you would download a spreadsheet full of coupon codes, and then you would push them out to devices, and whoever was using that device would redeem that code in their account, and then that code would be gone. And that was how it worked from 2013 to 2014, until we got the managed distribution system for volume purchase. And in the previous system, you basically had devices, and you enrolled your devices in your device management system, and you would send configuration profiles to those devices, and then you send coupon codes to those devices, and that was essentially how you did your deployment. And that was nice and simple, because the only object you were managing was the device. But it didn't matter whether if you had one user who had multiple devices, or if each person only had one device, you still just managed the device.
Well, and it's important to remember that you did lose that code once it was on that device. Mm-hmm. Like, it was theirs forever, and that's why it didn't matter what device it was.
Yeah. And it was a little confusing because if you push the coupon code, then the user would sort of see that code in both places, but then they would redeem the code in one place, and it could lead to quite a lot of confusion. So when the managed distribution system came along, essentially what you now are able to do is you're able to map a license for an app to assign it, as the term would have it, to a Apple ID. And then it doesn't matter which devices are using that Apple ID, they will all get access to whatever app it is that you've just assigned to that Apple ID. And in principle, that's a much more sort of conceptually pure idea, right? Because we know that apps are owned by Apple IDs. They're not owned by devices. Because as you know, however many iOS devices you have, you can install the apps you've bought on those devices. But it's a little complexity for the sake of complexity when you're in a situation where every user only has one device anyway, such as a school with a one-to-one program. Whereas if you look at managing staff devices, you are in a situation where one user might actually have two or three devices enrolled in your device management server. So it's more flexible and more powerful, but a little more complex to manage.
Well, and the reason that, you know, even if they're not faculty, if you have staff on or school on devices, a lot of sysadmins require enrollment in your MDM in order to get access to the staff Wi-Fi.
And we do that as well. We basically, there's only one staff profile that we put on, which is basically that you have to have a passcode installed, configured on your device. But we do have staff devices enrolled in our MDM for sure. So what happens is Apple reinvents the whole system with this thing called managed distribution. And then as a result, one of the things about managed distribution is that the only way you can assign an app to an Apple ID is by doing it through your MDM system. Your MDM talks to the volume purchase, the app store, and it gets a list of apps you've bought automatically from the store. And then it communicates with the store to say, assign these apps to these Apple IDs. There's no actual communication between the MDM and the device when that happens. It's just between the MDM and the App Store to create that assignation of app to Apple ID. And then the system does the rest by pushing out a new app to the device. That is great. Until you realize that you've now got two different objects you have to manage in your MDM. You've got devices and you've got users. Now, I'm speaking mostly with reference to the way that Casper Suite does it, because that's what we use in school. But other MDMs will have a similar idea of some kind of representation of the user with the Apple ID and apps, and then a representation of the device. And in Casper, what happens is you have devices enrolled, you have users who have Apple IDs, and then you have to say which device, or devices, plural, are assigned to which user. So there's a mapping between devices and users, and then there's a mapping between users and apps. Now, that mapping between a user and an app is called the VPP assignment. Okay, I'm just trying to get the terminology right before we go any further with this. A VPP assignment says, here's a set of apps. Those apps are assigned to a certain set of users. Okay. Configuration profiles can only be sent to devices. So configuration profiles go to devices, apps go to users. And then users and devices are connected by setting the owner of the device to be a specific username in your system. Make sense so far? Okay. So the question is, how do you manage these groups? How do you group these devices and users in such a way that those groups don't have to be recreated every year? This is essentially the problem. Like you identified at the start, Bradley, if I create a group that's, say, primary 2-3, which is this year's group, then next year, if half of that class join up with another class or whatever, or if they become their own class, then that grouping is no longer valid and I have to take it apart again. And that's become a bit of a problem. And what I've got at the moment is I've got some classes that are kind of grouped for the way they were last year, rather than the way they are this year, and certainly not grouped for the way they're going to be next year. So I have to figure out a way in which I can group users according to some much more stable grouping, and I don't want any year-specific group names in there, and also the groups of devices. How do I want them to be? Because at the moment I've got static groups of devices, which are this year group, that year group, but those are based on various criteria, and it's a real pain. I'm going to have to unpick this quite carefully. So I don't want to go into in too much detail exactly the kind of painful structure that I have at the moment. If you want to read that information, you can read the blog post, which we'll link in the show notes, which explains in excruciating detail how bad the system is at the moment. But suffice to say, I got too clever. And I think this is really the lesson I want to leave from this show, Bradley, is that as few structures as possible is the right way to go. Does that sound like good advice?
Yeah, it's always better to keep it simple. I think that allows you to be more flexible in the long term. You know, my Wi-Fi is largely set up that way. I don't try to group the devices and these filters by floor or building. Just take it for what it is, and that allows you to kind of get a higher level. And it's kind of like this to me, the same concept of not trying to get too cute with your configuration profiles. Mm-hmm. Like, keep it simple. If you don't, because sometimes it's hard to, like, if you've got something that's, you know, maybe not working or it's not allowed, it's not always, you're not always sure, like, what policy is holding that back. So keep it as simple as possible. And my thing is give the user as open a device as possible. And so you kind of want to do the same thing here. Like, keep your MDM as open as possible in terms of, like, what your insight is. You know, of course, we complain that these things are rolling over every year. And obviously, regular business does not have to deal with that as much. They'll have much more consistent turnover throughout the year, where in schools, it's big lump sums of turnover. So you have these grades are just constantly, you know, shuffling in and out. But we thankfully have the summer to do that generally. And that's the nice thing is, you know, when you're thinking through these structural changes, you almost get a partial redo every summer, and you certainly get a full redo every 3 years. So even if you've made a really bad design, how long are you going to keep these devices?
Yeah, and this is kind of the thing I'm trying to decide right now is, do I try and unpick all of this between now and the summer, basically? Or do I just say, right, I'll live with it for another year, and then I'll just, like, completely reboot the MDM, you know, wipe the database, start over, and re-enroll everything when we get new devices in summer 2016.
Yeah, I'm actually going to do that this summer. I am going to re-image every iPad that we own. I'm going to pull all the apps off, pull all the configuration profiles off, and remove the MDM profile and start it back from scratch. And I think there's just some errors I get here and there that I think are related to old configurator profiles. That were on old versions of it. So I'm just going to kind of take the summer to reboot it all and kind of and see how it goes. I guess this is like we're getting to the point where we have like legacy sysadmin techniques for iPad deployments.
Yeah, I suppose you're right. Actually, that is that is the situation we're in now, particularly with the transition to managed distribution, is that we do have the holdover of previous ways of doing things. And I suppose the first situation we were in with that was when volume purchase was invented in 2012, 2013. But I think the managed distribution stuff is more of a technique change than that was overall.
And then I was actually on the phone today during lunch with a business up in Indiana that's looking at becoming a MDM reseller. And so they were just kind of more exploring the, you know, this is typically kind of a Windows MSP type organization. So they were exploring like, you know, some of the structural changes of how iPad deployments work and just thinking through that. And, you know, when I explained to them about, you know, I give an example of an Apple deployment, like in a car lot where they hand the car salespeople an iPad to look up information, to process loans, things like that. Well, those people are not taking those iPads home. They stay there. They're not putting their personal email on there. They're not putting their games on there. Those are simply like just basically displays for them to look up. These are kiosks to them. Well, currently there still has to be an Apple ID assigned to that. And in those situations, they certainly don't want the employee's personal Apple ID. So currently the IT department would have to either sync them through Configurator, which is a pain, especially if it's like a large car dealership organization where they maybe have multiple around the city or multiple around the country. And so otherwise, they're going to have an individual Apple ID per device. And so that's, we've mentioned many times, that's the rumor change that's coming, is where you won't have to, you can do over-the-air app installations without each device having its own Apple ID. So if that comes, you have, particularly like in your lower school, where you've created individual Apple ID per student, you might have another kind of cleanup process with that.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things that another thing I'm debating with myself is, do I even bother changing things now, or do I wait again and see if there's going to be another change? I mean, I don't think the technique that I'm using at the moment of individual Apple IDs will become invalid in the future. I think it's obviously still going to be a supported configuration, because that's how most personal model deployments are done. But, you know, might there be a simpler way in the future to do it? Quite possibly. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that is the challenge. And do you want to do all the work this summer, and then in the fall they say, hey, coming next spring, and you're like thinking, okay, I just did all this work, and you are mid-cycle. Now, if this was coming off the first year of your deployment, I might more suggest that you take the time to do that. But it really, and I think you have to ask yourself, like, what am I going to miss out on if I don't do this? Like, what structurally is going to be hard next year because of that? And depending on how hard that answer is, it would be my indication if I'd go through with it or not. Or obviously, you're not waiting forever. You're just waiting until your next refresh and to do it all at once.
Yeah, that's the question. Of course, not being in the US means that I get an extra year to wait for all these things. Maybe I'll do it anyway. But let me tell you about two ways that I think I'm going to cut this in the future. Right? I want to tell you about the way I'm going to group and manage the devices, and then we'll talk about the way I'm going to group and manage the users, which is actually the harder of the two parts. Does that make sense to cut it that way? Is that okay? In Casper, you enroll the devices, and those devices become records in their database. One device, one record. But you can group those devices by essentially four different ways. You can assign a building to the device if you have a multi-site, which we don't. So buildings aren't really a useful grouper for us. You can put a device into a specific department. You can edit the device's information and say this device is in this department, which I've actually done in the past. That was one of my mistakes, I think, was to I declared that classes were equal to departments. And then this is from the 2013 deployment. I said each device is in a certain department. The problem was that departments are not really designed to be kind of changed very frequently, so it's a wee bit of a pain to kind of sort of reassign those departments if you have to. But you can also make static groups of devices and dynamic groups of devices, which Casper calls smart groups. And the static groups, you just give it a name and say these devices are in the group. And then for dynamic groups, you can say this group is defined by these devices having certain criteria. And that's how I've created groups of classes of devices before. Because if you remember, before managed distribution, when you were assigning coupon codes to devices, it was important to be able to target specific class groups of devices so you could put the right apps on them. Today, that's not important because when you're doing managed distribution, you only have to assign apps to users and you never assign apps to devices anymore. So the question is, do I actually have any need to have individual class groups of devices in order to target configuration profiles at them? And when I looked at it, the answer for me was really no, right? That almost all the configuration profiles that we deploy to student devices, all of them go to the same people, right? So almost every pupil in the school gets the same 11 configuration profiles on their device. I'll tell you why that is. It's because every configuration profile controls at least at most one or two parameters so that we can layer them and remove them as needed rather than having one configuration profile for everybody. So far, so good?
Yes, and we do that same thing where the policies we apply over the JAMP software is it's like there's one for this, one for that. And it kind of makes it easy to see, you know, what's what in terms of which devices have which, you know, as you're pushing them out, as you're pushing out updates, and they're not all, mm-hmm. it's not just kind of one big policy.
Yeah, the only downside to having multiple policies is the possibility that one might fail. And you might see the device looking on first inspection as if it's got your profiles because you see five things on your home screen that you expect to see there, like maybe FaceTime is missing and there's a web clip and so on. But then there might be one that isn't there. So you have to kind of check that up on that. But I think the flexibility is worth it. But the only exception to that is that our five-year-olds don't have to have the passcode profile. We just let them not use a passcode for the first year in school. So what I reckon in the long term is that I'm just going to have one big group that says school-owned iPads. And if you're a school-owned iPad, you get these set profiles. One group for all the devices. And if there are kids who need to not get a certain profile, Casper has a method of saying target this group of devices with certain exclusions. So it will omit devices that are in the exclusion list, and then it will apply the profile to the rest. And I think that's how I might get around situations where I need to exclude somebody from a certain profile. I had another situation last year where one of the senior students was using an app and they'd done a lot of work in the app, but in order to export the file, they needed to complete an in-app purchase. And we generally have in-app purchase turned off for everybody, but I had to give him an exclusion to be able to do the in-app purchase. So I just put his device into the exclusion list for that configuration profile. So having the target everybody and then exclude a few is a really nice way to get around having to make two distinct sets and manage the composition of those sets separately. So I think it's going to be a big, big simplification for device management. The device management is just to have one big group and deal with the exceptions through exclusions rather than having separate classes and, you know, targeting one profile at like 8 out of 10 classes or something like that.
Yeah, again, it goes back to, you know, you've got years of experience in how you use it. And so when you're setting up, we might think we will use the system a certain way, but in practice we don't. And we use it a lot simpler than we thought we would.
Yeah, because I thought when we started a couple of years ago with MDM that I would be spending all my time layering on profiles and taking off profiles and doing this with a profile and doing that with a profile. And in fact, over the course of the 2 years that we've been using it, I have almost never done anything like that. We have those profiles, we set them up at the start, and everybody gets them. And only very occasionally do we have a couple of other profiles. We've got one that turns off the App Store and one that turns off the camera. And we use them for disciplinary reasons, and I've applied them a few times, but, you know, for a week at a time, for maybe four pupils in total ever. So it's not something that I'm you know, I've got to do it from my phone because it's such a frequent thing. I do it once or twice a year. So the profiles, to me, in my experience, have been much more stable than I expected. But what has been less stable than I expected is the apps. And requests for apps and additions for apps and removal of apps is something that I do spend a lot more time on. But the fundamental technique for doing that over these past 2 years has changed radically from being assigning apps to devices to now assigning apps to users. I think it'd probably be worth digging into how I think I'm going to structure that as time goes on. You want to do one more sponsor before I go there?
Yeah, last sponsor of the night. It is the fine folks at Shobi. Now, Shobi's been with us for many, many months now. They are an iPad app for paperless classrooms. So if you're a teacher that's wanting to get rid of the paper, this is an app you want to check out. So with Shobi, teachers can quickly and easily assign, collect, and review student work on their iPads. They can then provide rich feedback to students by adding annotations, text notes, and voice notes directly onto documents. Students can show their learning creatively by submitting to Shobi from thousands of compatible iPad apps or by completing assignments with Shobi's built-in tools. Shobi keeps everyone organized with individual student assignment folders, email, and push notifications. So if you want to try Shobi out, they have a free version called Shobi Basic. You can search for Shobi on the App Store and get started for free. That's S-H-O-W-B-I-E. Now, they have a pro upgrade that you, if you use the app, you'll definitely want to check out. And if you buy Shobi Pro for five of your teachers, you can get five for free for the full year. So go to shobi.com/out of school for details on that. And we'll have the links to all that in the show notes at outofschool.net. And this is show 132.
Okay, cool. So last leg of the journey, right, is how do we manage the users? And this is more difficult. And it's more difficult because of a number of reasons, right? The first one is that if we just named it for class year groups, then those year groups would have to all be changed next year. And sometimes, like in a school like ours, we often have composite classes where we have like primary two and primary three in the one classroom. And next year it might be 3-4 if they all go up together, or it might be primary 4-5 and 2-3 next year, or 1 and 2 the year after that, and 3 and 4, and then 5 and 6 or whatever. And that tends to change year on year depending on class sizes and depending on space in the school and different things like that. So even in a bigger school, it might be the case that those groupings are actually quite stable and you could just move them along like that. But I suspect probably not. So what I'm looking for is I'm looking for a way to group students in a stable way, but also kind of dynamically make another layer of groups on top of that that represent this year's classes, so that those groups may have to be recreated once a year, but fundamentally the users are still in the kind of groups that they are always in. And the way I thought to do that, Bradley, was to look at the year the students are going to graduate. Right, so you've got class of 2015, class of 2016, class of 2017, class of 2025, 26, 27. And that's a reasonably stable number for all those kids. So if you're born a certain year, the year you're going to leave school is most likely going to be a specific year. And only in the rare case of students either being accelerated or being held back a year would somebody actually jump from one of those groups to another. For the most part, people in that who are in that group at 5 years old are still in that same group at 18 when that year comes around. And this is a technique that we've already used to organize a lot of information on Google Drive. We have a big pupil profile folder, and in there we have class of 2020, class of 2021, and the students tend not to move around inside that folder. If they're in there, they stay there. So we're looking at year of graduation as a sort of stable grouping of students, and only very rarely, once every 5 years maybe, will we have somebody who's going to jump from one of those to the other.
And you'll just have to, in your mind, start to figure out, okay, first grade is this class, fifth grade is class of X, 11th grade is class of X. That's, it'll be harder for the younger ones until you get the flow of it. And then your mind won't really have to change, but once a year, you'll have one new class every year, and that's it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so one will roll off the top and one will roll in the bottom. It's just the only thing that's difficult about that is that's not really how we think of people. We think of them as what class are they in this year. But it's funny, we always sort of say there's always like one child every year who's like they're like the archetypal pupil for that class. So we talk about S2 Sophie's class, or S3 Robert's class, and S4 Amy's class, or whatever. And there's always seems to be like one pupil whose name. So maybe we should just sort of name the classes after a particular person that comes to mind whenever you think of that class. But it's not really the way we think about naming classes or naming groups. So it's a wee bit of a kind of, you sort of start by thinking, well, okay, the 6 year this year, their class of 2015 and then class of 2016, 17, 18, sort of work your way back from the top of the school because you know in your mind that the oldest class are going to graduate this year, and then you sort of work your way all the way down to the class of 2027, which is the youngest kids at the moment. So the other thing that I want to be able to do, though, is I want to be able to say, well, for this year, the class of 2027 and the class of 2026 are in the same classroom with the same teacher. The class of 2025 are by themselves, and the class of 2024 and 23 are in a group together, and then 21, 20, 19, 18 are all their own individual classes. So I was originally thinking, well, maybe what I do is I just create a what Casper calls a smart group, which is a group whose membership is defined by a certain criteria, and just have that smart group select two of the static groups, if you like, and then that might be the way to do it. Okay, but I managed to simplify it on top of that, and there's two ways that I simplified it. One is, I don't know if you've used this in Casper, Bradley, but there's such a thing called the extension attributes in Casper. And this means what you're able to do with an extension attribute is for user records and for computer records, you can define essentially a key value pair that is attached to each record in the database of that type. And you can say what the name of that pair is, and you can define its available values. So what I thought I would do is to add an extension attribute to the user object that says this user has a graduation year of 2025 or whatever, and then use that as a selection criteria to create the smart groups that would be those individual class of, right? So let's say Bob comes to the school. He's going to graduate in 2020. I would create his user account, set his year of graduation to be 2020, and then my smart group that creates his graduation cohort, he would automatically be added to that by virtue of his graduation year being set correctly. So that's the first level of grouping, is those smart groups that then select on a user's graduation year, and then I use that smart group later on. Okay? Now, a class in school parlance, a class is a combination of one or more graduation years. And I thought, well, maybe what I'll do is I'll make smart groups of classes, and then I'll assign all the apps to those classes. But I realized I could even simplify that as well. And in Casper, as I said earlier, what you can do is you can use what's called a VPP assignment, which is in Casper, and many other MDMs will have a similar thing. That's where you take a set of apps, say, you know, these 10 apps for this class, and I say all of those apps are assigned to a specific group of students. So instead of me having to say, here's a class, and then the class is composed of multiple graduation groups, and then the apps are assigned to that class, what I can just do is I can drop the middle idea out, and I can just say, these apps are assigned to these two graduation groups. And then the class is actually defined as the mapping between apps and groups of graduations. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it totally makes sense.
So it's complicated to say it loud, but it sort of makes sense once you see. So if you draw a little sketch while I'm talking, it might make a little bit more sense. But if I do that, then all I end up with is a list of apps assigned to one or two graduation groups that are happen to be in a class together this year. So when it comes to next year, all I do is I just revoke the apps from the students, which I would probably be doing anyway at that year, and then just recreate new assignments to two and remap the assignment to different groups, and then repush the apps again the next year. And what that'll do is that means that I've only got VPP assignments and the extended attribute in the user, and then one simple group between the two, which is the graduation cohort. And those graduation cohorts, in principle, never need to be changed again, right? The class of 2020 all have a graduation year of 2020, right? Simple enough. Whereas the VPP assignments would have to be recreated anyway because teachers want different apps each year. So that's no more additional work. And then say a user does have to be moved between graduation years, all I do is I go into their user record and I change their graduation year plus or minus one. They'll automatically be moved into a different group, And then that the rest will be the rest at that point. Make sense?
Yes. It's one of those things, again, I don't... It's just thinking through, like, it's school organization in much the same way you organize a lot of things, and it's applying mm-hmm. that to our technology deployment organization.
Yeah. It's all about trying to not do too much work in the summer, I think. You know, it's in some ways tearing down your MDM and recreating it from scratch is the easy way to do it. It's work, don't get me wrong, and it's probably unscalable if you have, say, 5,000 devices. But for small schools like you and I, Bradley, the temptation is always to kind of just redo everything every year because it's not that much more work. But I'm kind of getting to an age and stage where I quite like having a summer holiday, and getting 2 out of 3 would be not bad. So I'm trying to figure out these ways in which I can... my aim for this deployment has been to deploy the iPads in 2013, and I don't want to see those iPads back until 2016. And so far, I'm doing okay with that. The volume purchase managed distribution stuff has been very effective in reducing the amount of time I have boxes of iPads back in my classroom. I've done it once this year just to update people to iOS 8. Because there's an iOS 8 setup assistant I wanted to get right for people. But apart from that, and certainly for the senior kids, I have not, there's many iPads that I touched last on, you know, the 20th of August 2013, and I haven't touched them again since. And that's been my aim for this 3-year deployment. And so far, so good. It's the way I want it to work.
I don't want to see it back unless it's broken.
Basically that, yeah. And eventually when we get device enrollment, I think that will become even easier again. Fingers crossed. Okay, so that's kind of my story right now about MDM design for the long term. And it's basically a substantial simplification of what we've done before. Because previously we had all these device groups. Devices were grouped in classes, and then students were grouped in classes, and then students' department was also their class, but then I made extra classes on top for this year that don't match last year and blah, blah, blah. And it was all kind of a mess and a hack. And one of my aims is just to kind of simplify so much of that away so that people only have, we only have like the bare minimum set of structures that we need. And I can potentially draw a simple diagram of how configuration profiles get to devices and how apps get to users. And that's understandable to everybody. So fingers crossed. Should work.
Yes.
Works in theory. It works in my head anyway. And it works on my blog. And my job now is to try and make it work in practice as well. I want to talk about one more thing just before we go, Bradley, if that's okay.
Yes.
Is we also had some digital exams recently.
Your favorite part of the year?
My favorite week in the year. Fortunately, thankfully, it went well this year. And we've actually been doing this for 3 years now, maybe 4, where kids will actually use their iPad to sit an exam. And I have a very old post on my blog about, I essentially worked out an attack tree for how a student might be able to cheat in a digital exam. And it's quite, I made it quite difficult for them. It wasn't easy. But I think what I've kind of learned looking at it this year is that guided access has taken care of so many of these problems for us. It's not to say that there aren't other security measures you want to take apart from just turning on guided access, but guided access is a lot more reliable now than it was in iOS 6 when it first came in. Don't know if you ever had any situations where guided access would sort of get itself stuck on, and the only way to get it out was to actually erase the device, which was kind of terrifying. But guided access in iOS 8 is way, way better than it was before. So just a couple of things that I learned from sort of practicing our setup for this year. One is if there are any elements in the app that you want to disable, and I'll give you an example, in Pages, for some students, we want to disable the spell checking. So what we do is we go into the tool menu in Pages and turn off spell checking, and then we use guided access to blank out being able to tap on the tool menu so the student can't turn it back on during the exam. The problem is that square doesn't track that user interface element if you rotate the device. So you have to actually turn off rotation. And you can do that in gated access. You can disable rotation so that the device is only in landscape mode, which turns out to be fine for the kids anyway. Also, using a PIN code to stop gated access is kind of obvious. But also, there is now an option for you to enable or disable the hardware buttons, such as the volume control and so on. And we had a situation, fortunately not in a final exam, but just in a practice test that we did, where one of the students was using speak selection on their iPad, but we accidentally forgot to enable the volume buttons. So the iPad was locked into full volume at all times, and there was no way for the student to turn the volume down. So they were kind of getting their ear blasted off by this iPad talking to them. But that's another thing just to be aware of, that those are actually disabled by default, and you have to go into the options button to turn them on as well. The other thing is we have just a sort of mother of all configuration profiles that turns off every single thing you can think of. We use a firewalled SSID so that students can print their exam at the end. This is our digital exams in Scotland. The way you do it is you sort of type it on the computer, then you print it out on paper and send it away with the same documents as the students who did the exam on paper. It's a digital exam. It's not an online exam. So that's just an important distinction. We also delete the pre-installed dictionaries. There's a couple of dictionaries that come pre-installed with iOS 8, and you can download more. But if you delete them first, and you can delete them, then because the student's on a firewall, they cannot access the internet to re-download those dictionaries in flight, which is helpful. And then spell check on or off, depending on requirements. But it seems to me that there's a separate switch inside Pages for turning spell check on and off that maybe overrides the system setting. So you have to kind of check it in both places, both in settings, but also in Pages as well.
When you mentioned the firewalled SSID, is that the same one that you sent me over iMessage that you set up on your Wi-Fi? Mm-hmm. So basically, how you do that in Aerohive and in really any Wi-Fi network that has firewall rules built in is you basically allow the device to get on the local network and grab DHCP, and then you block everything after that.
Yeah, and that was the bit that I found a little bit tricky just to get started, was to make sure that DHCP traffic was flowing all around the network. And the reason is so that it could contact the AirPrint printer. But thanks to gated access and also the profile that turned off Safari and iMessage and everything else, that there was essentially no other way for the student to get to another device that could provide the iPad with information. So it was quite good that we're able to enforce the firewall, enforce the locking into one app, and so on, so that it was a fairly tightly locked down system. And then, of course, you've got a person in the room checking as well to make sure that they're not cheating in any way. So that was how we were doing these iPads for exams this year.
You know, the way you've set that up for AirPrint would not work if you're a Chromebook deployment, because of the way the Chromebook printing works, it actually uses the internet, because the Google Cloud Print enabled printer actually gets online to receive the document. And that's how you're able to print anywhere in the world to that printer, regardless of where you're at. So we'd need to get a little, I don't know how we'd probably have to figure something out, how that thing is communicating, and just allow that. That'd be difficult though.
Yeah, you'd probably have to allow a certain port to a certain IP address from that device, because with Cloud Print, all of your data goes to the internet before it even comes back to your on-site printer. So that's quite challenging. And also you'd have to share your printer with the effective logged-in user ID of the person who was taking the test. So it's not by no means impossible, I don't think, but a little more complex than my blanket kind of allow internal but deny everything else. So that's kind of where we're at with digital exams right now. We've kind of increasingly moved away from trying to use the PDF versions of exam papers, and where it's allowed, mostly in kind of essay-based subjects, where we prefer much more often to use Pages as a way for the students to type in the answers, because Pages has proven to be a lot more stable than PDF readers of various kinds. So we try and encourage students to do that as much as possible, which has worked well for us the past couple of years.
Yeah, it's always a fun week. It's like the Monday it starts. It's all right, it's go time. Let's do this.
It's the worst. But anyway, there's not that many more of them to go. Yeah, we've got a couple. We've got one student who's actually using a Mac this year because they're using the main reason they're using the computer in the exam is to have the computer read the exam paper to them. And the voices on the Mac are much better quality than the voices in iOS. So the student's got a Mac to speak to her, basically, and then they complete the answers on paper. So it's different combinations every year of what does the student need. Everybody's kind of situation is different, and we go through a process before the exam start of trying to work out. Well, firstly, we have to ask ourselves, does this technical intervention actually change the student's performance in any way? Do they get any benefit? Can we demonstrate that their low marks in this test or whatever are due to some impediment to them completing the test rather than they just don't understand the question? Does that make sense? So it's kind of like you would sort of do give them the normal paper-based test and then give them a computer version have somebody read it to them or whatever you're going to propose to do in the exam, and you have to sort of show that they actually can do it. It's just the form of the assessment is a burden to them, and they have some problem that means they can't get past the fact that they have to read more or something. If a student has an eye problem and they can't read for extended periods of time, then having the computer or a person read it to them will allow them to actually answer the questions in the way that they're perfectly able of doing once they have the information in their heads. So that's kind of the first stage. And then the next stage is, well, what exact interventions are going to be correct and helpful for that student? And that's something that process is done for every student separately. There are sometimes cases where, kids have got bad handwriting or whatever, and the handwriting is scrappy, and sometimes people suggest, maybe they should do their answers on a computer or something like that. But in fact, if you look at the measurements, sometimes, you mark their work and you say, yeah, the handwriting was hard to read, but all the marks they lost were because they answered the question wrong and not because I just couldn't read what they wrote. And it's just different ways, different times, depending on the student. But one of the possible interventions is actually giving the student a computer, just let them type on it and then print out the paper and send it away. And that's what we've done recently, and it has so far worked. So hooray for iPads. Hooray for Pages.
Oh, and that was one of the things we referenced back in our deployment series is start with the device and then figure out the exceptions. Don't immediately think, mm-hmm. you're going to have all these exceptions. Figure it out first.
Yeah, yeah. No, most definitely. So that's been my last week and this week is digital exams and then trying to figure out MDM for the long term. I'll report back once I get the job done, but basically I have to go through and add a year of graduation to every user record in my MDM right now, which is time-consuming but not intractable.
Well, yeah, we'll be interested to hear about that over the summer.
Yeah. Okay. Shall we leave it there for now?
Yes, perfect. Sounds good. Mm-hmm. Be back next week as we kind of get a little three-part series on some MDM stuff. So if that's something that interests you, definitely check back next week. We're going to work through a MDM wish list on what we would like to see on some new deployment techniques based on what we are wanting to do. So, yeah, definitely mm-hmm. check back next week.
Yep. And then I think what we'll do after that, Bradley, is we'll take a look at how configuration profile design has changed since the last time we talked about it, which is quite a while ago. There's a substantial range of new controls that are possible as well. So we'll highlight some of those and talk about different ways in which you might want to deploy some of those things.
Yeah, sounds good. Thanks to our sponsors tonight, Squarespace, Jamp Software, and Shobi. I'm Bradley Chambers on Twitter and chambersdaily.com on the web.
And I'm spears.org on the web and Fraser Spears on Twitter.
Have a good week, everybody.